Welcome to the Music Therapy Roundtable Podcast. We are your hosts, Rachel Rambach,
Michelle Erford,
Matt Logan,
and Kimberly Senna Moore.
We are four board-certified music therapists with a mission to empower you to take charge of your personal and professional growth. Join us each month as we talk shop and share stories, tips, and ideas about music therapy. Thanks for stopping by.
I am so thrilled to finally be talking to you all. Listeners, we're recording this episode much later than we typically do. So apologies for it being late, but we had really good reasons. We've had conferences, we've had sicknesses. This is actually the third time we've rescheduled the recording of this call. So we're thrilled to actually be here and be able to put out this episode for you. But I'm also excited. Originally, we weren't sure that Matt was going to be able to join, but because of our third reschedule, he is. The reason we weren't sure was that you were at last week, the Western Regional Conference for Music Therapy, and you were really involved in it too.
I was really involved. I was the local conference chair, so it was a whirlwind. It was a whirlwind, but it was so much fun to be able to serve the region in that way, and then also to just to be able to see the inner workings of a conference. It was, I had never really experienced that, and I'll never look at conferences the same way again.
Well, I was going to ask, I've told you this already, I knew some people who went to this conference, and I heard really positive things about it. But what surprised you most about being kind of behind the scenes in that way?
What surprised me most? Well, I think, first of all, just how much work it is and how many people have to come together to do things that are outside of the normal tasks of a music therapist, you know, the logistical pieces, just all of the different pieces, the scheduling, the marketing pieces, that music therapists don't often have to do, or not, at least not all music therapists. So it was a really great learning experience for me, and I think for the other local committee members, because there were just so many different skills that we got to build, so many different muscles that we got to flex, you know. So that really surprised me, and pleasantly so, because, you know, as a leader of that team, as the local chair, it was a great experience being able to delegate and really have confidence in the team to be able to get these things done and to keep their conference running smoothly. And that was just a great feeling.
Right. Because when you're thinking about AMTA conferences on the national level, the people who are organizing, on the regional level, the people who are doing the planning for that all have day jobs. It's not like the national conference where there are people whose sole purpose is to plan that conference, not for the regional folks. Those are all individual wonderful Joe Schmo music therapists who are also planning a conference. You know, it's huge, huge amount of work and skills and everything.
And you've been on that side of it too, Michelle, right? Because you were on the, you helped when the national conference was in Jacksonville.
Yeah, I helped on the national level because I was the, what's the title again, Matt? The same thing as you.
Wheelchair.
Yeah. But we had co-chair. They were two. And if it wasn't for the AMTA staff who plan these conferences, I wouldn't have known what to do at all. So it's just a lot of work, a lot of emailing, a lot of organization. But I also didn't do a lot compared to what you did, Matt, because I had the ultimate help, I guess you could say. Because it was a national level.
I had a lot of help as well, but the whole team just really impressed me and inspired me. So it was a lot of fun.
Well, and congratulations then, Matt. Good work.
Well, thank you. Thank you. You know, I want to talk about a few more pieces of it, but I'll do it quickly. Okay. It was really cool because we had a house band that was made up of committee members, and we played all – so our conference was in San Jose, so we played all Bay Area songs. We were doing Janis Joplin, Jefferson Airplane, Santana, Grateful Dead. So that was definitely a highlight, and it was so fun. Kalani sat in on congas, and Tim Ringgold sang Black Magic Woman. We didn't have a bass, like bass guitar, but Lauren Bevilacqua, who many know for her work with continuing education, she played the sousaphone. So our bass lines were provided by a sousaphone. It was just such a cool sound and such a cool way to draw on the musical skills and talents of all these music therapists. And, you know, we only had but maybe two or three rehearsals, and it all came together and people were dancing and singing along to this great Bay Area music, you know, CCR. It was a lot of fun.
Awesome. I hope that there's some video or audio footage of that.
You know, I hope so too. If anybody listening has some,
let Matt
post
know.
It or let me know. Yeah, let me know, because I obviously wasn't able to videotape it because I was playing. It was really cool.
That's awesome.
So that's it. That's all I'll say about it. But it was a really fun conference. And I am glad it's over, but it was a really fun conference.
The 2015 Scope of Music Therapy Practice defines music therapy as, quote, the clinical and evidence-based use of music interventions to accomplish individualized goals for people of all ages and ability levels within a therapeutic relationship, this is really long, by a credentialed professional who has completed an approved music therapy program. Whew. One of the characteristics outlined early in this definition is evidence-based, which implies a focus on research. In this episode 64 of the Music Therapy Roundtable podcast, we'll talk about research and, more specifically, we'll share our experiences as researchers and/or research consumers, as well as how we incorporate research in our practice. So I want to open briefly talking about this is actually a recent Four Corners podcast episode I created for Music Therapy Pro, but the topic of this episode was on debunking research myths. And I'm not going to get into the specifics of all the myths that were covered, but one was the claim that we do not have enough music therapy research. And I've heard music therapists and non-music therapists say this alike. And I just want to share, I don't know if you all have other thoughts, but I do want to highlight and point out that in my perspective, we have over 65 years of music therapy research. So we actually have a rather large body of research. So I don't see at all that we don't have enough research in our field. We have over 65 years, and it keeps getting better. That's the other thing. We keep getting more. It keeps getting better. So I don't know if you all have other thoughts, but I wanted to just throw that one out there to get things rolling.
Yeah, I thought of you the other day, Kimberly, when I was reading an article about the neurochemistry of music, and I'm going to read a bit of it and see if it strikes any chords with you, okay? So it's just a quick passage. So this is from Mona Lisa Chanda and Daniel J. Levitin. Daniel Levitin wrote the book, This Is Your Brain on Music, right?
Yeah, and so, I know this article, and it's a great article. I love that article.
Yeah, it is. It is. But this piece jumped out at me mainly because of your Four Corners post on debunking research myths. So it goes, in contemporary society, music continues to be used to promote health and well-being in clinical settings, such as for pain management, relaxation, psychotherapy, and personal growth. Although much of this clinical use of music is based on ad hoc or unproven methods, an emerging body of literature addresses evidence-based music interventions through peer-reviewed scientific experiments. So would you agree that a lot of our clinical use of music. Now, he might not be describing music therapists specifically, but he's saying the clinical use of music is based on ad hoc or unproven methods. Would you agree with that?
I think that so this idea of there's not enough research or research isn't quote unquote good enough, that really depends on the perspective of who's talking. Because if you look at straight up the scientific method, there is some research in music therapy that is not as strong in that area, and there's some that's very strong. I will say that I think our research approaches and our research literature is getting stronger and more sophisticated, but that's also very much in line with other fields as well. We're also limited. I mean, we're a small and mighty profession, and so we don't have as many people conducting research as, say, in other fields. Mm-hmm. So I still stand by my claim that we actually do have a large body of research. Not all of it is as high quality, but the quality is getting better. And I think it's, in my personal opinion, especially in the last 20 or 30 years, the research quality has gotten stronger. And so the other piece I'll say about this is, individual studies may not be as strong, but what, and we have a lot of, they'll often have a lot of limitations, like maybe a smaller sample size, or, these aren't large multi-site studies and things like that. However, there are ways that you can combine and synthesize results. And some of these are through processes like systematic reviews. So it may not be one standalone study that has a lot of strength, but when you combine 10, 15, 20 different studies, you have much stronger conclusions that you can draw from them. So in terms of that specific phrase, the ad hoc unproven methods, there are certainly some studies that aren't as strong from a scientific methodological standpoint, but we do have, I think, a lot and still growing research base to support what we're doing. So that's my little soapbox on that. Yeah, what do you think?
Well, I tend to agree with you. I also took into consideration that perhaps he's not specifically addressing music therapy interventions. I think, we all know there are other music practitioners that are not necessarily board certified or trained in the same way that we are as music therapists, but still provide a service in medical settings. And perhaps he is at least in part alluding to those interventions as well that don't have the same history of research that music therapy does.
Another question I have is, when is enough? When do you, is that possible? You know,
it's never enough. It's called job security.
Yep.
No, but actually, that's a really good point, because here's the other thing too. Nothing, and this is not music therapy specific, nothing is proven. It's never, there's always room for error. So you can never say that, this study proves something, or it has been proven that music therapy does this. That, you can never say that. So there's really, theoretically never enough, but we certainly do have enough to support, and we're continuing to grow in our understanding of what is working and why. So it's just that our understanding deepens and more evidence supports it, but there's never enough. Does that answer your question, Michelle?
I guess so. It was more rhetorical, but thanks anyway.
Oh, sorry. I didn't realize it was rhetorical.
I know you were searching for the answer because you're
I know.
Research-minded.
In my little cerebral head here.
So let me ask you all three of you, another question, and that is, what are your experiences with research during your school time and your internship time? Rachel, you want to start with that?
Sure. Going through a music therapy master's program, we had, of course, courses that were dedicated just to research and learning the different ways and different methods of doing so. And I feel like they were a lot more based on like old school methods, just because, I mean, it wasn't so long ago that I was in grad school, but it was before really the advent of everything being digital and available online. So it was mainly had to do with like journals and being able to document sources the correct way and things like that. In my internship, I don't recall having to do a lot of quote unquote official research. I mean, for projects and things, I used more of the online resources that we really detailed in the Music Therapy Pro podcast. So I think I feel a lot more comfortable with those resources for that reason, just because I haven't had to go the more traditional route with my research.
Did you have a thesis with your master's program?
You know, actually, at my school, we were given the option to do either a traditional thesis or I can't remember what they called it, but like a thesis project or something like that.
Yeah, like a clinical type of project?
It wasn't necessarily clinical. It could really be on any topic. My topic was the use of Frank Sinatra's music with clients who have Alzheimer's or dementia. And because back in that, at that time, that was really where I saw myself practicing clinically. And as we all know, that did not work out that way. But it was because the topic was more unresearched, I guess. There wasn't as much out there on that specific topic, just because it was so narrow with that choice of music. I was able to use a lot more of the online sources and things like that. So while I did have to document things, it wasn't like a traditional thesis paper that you might have written for your master's degree.
Yeah. Yeah. How about you, Matt? What experiences have you had with research?
In my master's program at the University of Iowa, there's a pretty big emphasis on reading and being able to digest and analyze research and connect it to clinical work. So there's that. I would also say there's a fair amount of that in my internship as well. And of course, the articles were supporting the work I was doing in the different areas in a hospital. So if I was in pediatrics, the articles that I would be reading were related to pediatrics. And actually, in my own internship program, then where I was the internship supervisor, I enacted a similar program where I would supplement my interns' clinical work with relevant articles. I was going to say something else, but I've lost it for the moment.
It's gone.
It's gone. It's gone.
You also transferred some of that learning when you did the Lullaby CD, right? Because you built on – was that affiliated with your training, or was that just, you know, something you just –
That was skills? Actually – yeah, that was during my undergraduate training that I really – Yeah, that I really started that project, and it was a long project. It took about 4 years to really bring it to fruition. But that came out of just a senior project in my undergraduate training, and basically it was taking the available research to create a CD that would be appropriate in a NICU musically and would also support some of the things we know about infant-directed singing and how that affects attunement and caregiver-infant relationships. So yeah, I would say that's probably my first real practice in applying research to clinical intervention. Although I guess that could count as clinical intervention or could be used with clinical intervention.
Oh, totally. Absolutely. Yeah. How about you, Michelle?
Well, I don't remember. No, I remember. It feels so long ago. I actually was just, you caught me, because I was just Googling the name of the book that we used in school. So I just have my undergrad in music therapy. So, and I always kind of think of, oh, master's is when you really get into research. But now that I remember the research classes that we had, I still had a lot of research training. Because we had our basic research class, and our text for that was the Barbara Wheeler's Quantitative and Qualitative Perspectives Music Therapy Research book, which is fantastic, a great Bible, I kind of think of, for research. And both sides, I always think of both sides of research when you have the quantitative and the qualitative components. And research methods were sort of incorporated in our other classes. One of the classes that we had involved like learning behavior. It was called behavior tech, but it was kind of like an intro. I think you would kind of call it an intro class now, but we did a lot of behavior mod sort of techniques. And one of the projects that was a big project that we had to do was a self-improvement study. So we had to pick a task for ourselves to learn, and we kind of did that basic research and then planning of ourselves as a client. So like some people did, like they wanted to swear less or they wanted to exercise more or whatever. That was their self-improvement project. But we walked through all the areas of research. We had to, you know, look up articles and all that sort of thing. We always had a level of incorporating research that we found into our other classes that we had, whether it was sharing an article or talking about it in front of the class and that sort of thing. In my internship, I remember reading a lot of articles that my clinical supervisor had scheduled out for me to read. I didn't do research so much as learn from research at that time. But one article in particular that I really remember reading that had to do with, and it's like a million years old now, but it was about being an intern and intern perspectives and doing your internship. And I remember that was one of the first articles Janelle had me read. And it was really great. And I feel like it should be required reading for every intern.
That's awesome.
My story.
Yeah. Well, and I have very similar experiences as all three of you in terms of having, you know, learning about research in undergraduate classes and doing some application, you know, in terms of practicum projects and things like that, and class assignments. You know, I also got a unique opportunity. I think I got to serve as a research assistant as an undergraduate. They had this undergraduate research award that Dr. Kate Gefeller was able to secure through the University of Iowa, and I was able to serve for a year or two on her research team. So that was my, outside of the classroom, first exposure to actually working on a research project. And then, you know, more experiences, of course, with the master's and obviously the doctorate as well. I won't get into all of that. But so we all have this shared experience of learning about research and even conducting on either a small or a bigger scale some research. But as a clinician, then how do you use research, either doing it or accessing it, things like that? How do you use research in your practice now?
I wanted to, this reminds me of something that happened at this conference. So we were all giving our committee reports, and Eric Walden from the University of the Pacific is the research committee chair. And he got up to the podium and asked some questions. He said, raise your hand if you prepare music before going to see a client. You know, you look up a song, kind of figure it out. And said, I'm paraphrasing. I don't remember exactly what he said. Then he said, who looks into patient charts and other documents related to their client to see what they're working on and what your goals will be? And, of course, a number of music therapists raised their hand. Then he said, who opens a copy of the Journal of the Music Therapy before going to see a patient or a client? And the hands in the air were significantly fewer. And his point was the research committee wants to make a point of directing clinicians to relevant research and making it accessible and implementable. Is that a word, implementable?
You can make it a word.
I'm going to make it a word. I think if I'd have just been confident with that, no one would have batted an eye. Make it easy to implement for clinicians when they're doing their work. And it was, I thought, a really great message. That's
you
all.
Honestly, when it comes to researching, just as a 9-to-5 music therapist, that was the last thing on my mind because I was thinking of, I got to work with patients. I got to keep up my caseload. I've got, you know, XYZ, XYZ. And reading the research was something that was always on the back burner, as well as the only time that I really was like made it a point was when I had, this was especially in the hospital setting, maybe I had a client with a diagnosis I wasn't familiar with or something really, really specific was when I had time, I could find time to go to the research. And I think understanding how to prioritize and where the research priority could be used in my clinical life is a skill that I definitely need to develop.
Yeah. So I'm thinking back, Matt, to the story you're sharing about what Dr. Walden shared, and I actually thought it was going to go a completely different direction. I thought it was going to be, hey, who looks up music and who looks up patient chart? And I thought it was going to be, that's, you know, you are doing research when you're doing that. It went a completely different direction. That was a nice surprise, but.
Yeah, well, I think there are two things going on. First of all, yeah, it's like Michelle is saying, it's difficult to prioritize that when you are, you know, spending 75% of your time or 60 to 75% of your time seeing patients and you're trying to get your paperwork done. And then there are, you know, 100 other projects going on that you need to contribute to. And then at the end of the day, you're tired and it's hard to synthesize and analyze new research. So there's the clinical side of that. But then I think some of the research out there is difficult to put into practice. You might read an article and say, how in the world do I use this information? It's a study with the population with which I work. It's showing a benefit, but what exactly, I don't really understand the intervention, and I can see how many different variables there would be in real life. So I think it's a challenge to find the time, and then it can be a challenge to really put it into practice.
Yeah. Absolutely. I'm really, go ahead, Rachel.
I was just going to say that what Matt just said hits home for me exactly. I mean, especially when I was doing so much research for the NICU program that I've been working on getting up and running, I realized, you know, it's really kind of fun to do this research and to read all of these things and learn all of this stuff that I wasn't necessarily aware of before. And I would like to do more of that for my clinical practice. It's just a matter of having the time to do it and being able to take that one step further from reading it to actually implementing it in my practice. So I think that's probably the biggest challenge for me.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. And I think it's also one of the reasons why I'm so grateful that there are resources that can help with that. Like I'm thinking of the music therapy research blog. And part of the purpose of that blog is to synthesize and help translate what's happening in the research to, hey, here's what this means clinically. Here's how you can use it. It's also what AMTA does, and I know this is one of the, in music therapy pro, we share a bunch of resources, and this is one of them, is AMTA puts out these fact sheets, and it helps, again, to synthesize and make meaningful for the clinician, here's what the research is saying. Because that is hard, and nobody has enough time to look at it. I don't have enough time to, you know, look at the all of the research out there that I'd like to be able to do, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It is hard. So would you say that that's one of the most confusing things that you find about research, or just maybe a challenging thing? I mean, is it confusing, or...
I would say that it's more challenging to kind of connect the dots. It takes some work, and it often takes some help. What I find the most confusing about research is always the statistics. It's like, what is this? What kind of, why did they perform this test? What does that mean? And, you know, I've taken courses in that, and I've passed tests, and then it's like a year or two down the road, and I don't remember.
Yeah, I think it's like
the significance of this.
It's, yeah, one of those things where we memorize it for the test, and then putting it into practice and actually applying it is another story.
Right. That's... like understanding clinical significance is one thing. It's like, okay, yeah, I get that, but why did they? I always am confused by which tests are used, which statistical processes are used.
Oh, I still have to reference it and kind of go back. It's I totally agree with you. Absolutely. I still have to go back to my books and my references. Okay, what is this and what does it mean and why is it? And
I've got one other way that I use clinical research.
Oh yeah, please share.
I use it to build bridges with other professionals, other disciplines. For example, if I find an article that's interesting and new and relates to the brain or relates to something that might be of interest to one of our rehab docs or PTs or OTs, I might pass it along, say, hey, this is pretty cool. And, you know, just that, just to show A, that I'm staying up to date on the research, and this is who you're working with, you know, just so they know they're working with a clinician who's you know, keeping in touch with what's going on, and B, just because it shows that you know or you have an understanding of what they might find interesting, and it's like, hey, check this out.
And it's networking.
Yes, exactly.
Michelle's it's networking. Topic.
My no. favorite
and, thing. And it's advocating. It's advocacy, too.
It is.
Well,
it
that's is. The piece, you know, we share that with music therapists is and just on the advocacy specifically and related to networking, share that stuff not just with colleagues or doctors, but, you know, legislators or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Shows you're not just a pretty voice in a you know, with guitar background.
Exactly.
You know, things too.
There are brains behind that pretty voice. So while you're talking about that, I was also thinking back to, you know, when one of the primary ways I used research when I had a clinical practice in Colorado was for marketing purposes. You know, I used it, I synthesized it when I was sharing information, preparing, say, my website or different brochures and promotional materials. That's when I did a lot of digging to try to pull out, okay, what can I use here to support and help educate about what this whole music therapy thing is and what I'm doing. So it's kind of related to what you were saying, but it was very, you know, business, advertising, marketing specific.
Sure. Yeah. That can be to get clients or it could be to get funding.
Mm-hmm.
If you're a nonprofit program or a philanthropically supported program.
Yeah. Absolutely. And I know, Rachel, you did that recently too when you were developing. The NICU program, right? You had to pull together this information as a way to support, hey, here's why this is going to be valuable for your hospital.
Yeah. And that was, I found really fun. Like I was saying before, you know, being able to take that research and use it in a way that was going to be helpful, not only to me, the person that was going to be putting this program into action, but also to the people that I was presenting it to in order to make it to make them see that it was, you know, worthwhile and evidence-based. So that kind of spurred me to want to do more of it in my own clinical practice in other realms.
Yeah, I was going to say, maybe that's kind of a takeaway from this, because it can be kind of fun and interesting, inspiring to read it. And so maybe we need to try to seek out more of those opportunities, or, you know, force, give ourselves reasons to have to do it, like develop a new program.
There you go. Exactly. Yeah.
For yourself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I do want to mention, you know, I'm thinking about some of the presentations I've had to give and the different types of audiences that I've had to present to. And I find that it is helpful to take into consideration who's in the audience. And some groups may be more interested or moved by statistical data, and others might be more moved by anecdotes and you know, sharing stories and examples. So I think good presentations do incorporate some of the anecdotes and case studies that you work with too. So I think the research and the statistical support is really important, but I don't want to forget about the powerful stories that we all have.
Yeah, I completely agree. You need to people will remember how you make them feel. And so the research provides kind of the science support, you know, the logical support, but that's not what's going to convince people.
Mm-hmm.
Awesome. So we're going to be delving more into music therapy research and actually more specifically about different resources that we use and recommend, kind of our go-to research resources, over on our premium website, musictherapypro.com. This pro conversation is only available to our pro community, who also have access to a members-only forum, resource lists, videos, exclusive podcasts, and discounts with select members. CMTE courses are also available to community members at no additional charge. At Music Therapy Pro, we've done the hard work already. Now we're sharing our secrets with you. Join the community at www.musictherapypro.com. This month's cool resource of the month is actually kind of giving our whole profession in some way a big old pat on the back. Recently, and we'll share the link in the show notes, ABC named music therapists as their persons of the week. And it was a really nice, I thought it was a really nice, just short little media piece, about 4 or 5 minute video. And they went and they interviewed and had clips from music therapists around the country. I remember I saw Andrew Littlefield on there, and Ryan Judd, and Megan Morrow, who worked with Representative Gabby Giffords. That was kind of the primary, I guess, footage used on that. But I thought, a really nice piece. And so that is our cool resource of the month. We'll have the link in the show notes, so please check it out.
And of course, we'd like to give a huge shout out to our Pro Perk partners. Music Therapy Pro members receive discounts on products and services from Metro Music Therapy's paper, Music Therapy eBooks, Music Therapy mailings, Wholesome Harmonies Music Therapy, A Perfect Lullaby, the Music Therapy Research Blog, Listen and Learn, the Music Therapy Maven, and Bear Paw Creek. Thank you so much for your support.
And we also have a couple of announcements to share with you, the first of which concerns one of our co-hosts, and that is Dr. Kimberly Senna-Moore. So yay to Kimberly for completing her doctorate. And Kimberly, tell us what the final process was for that and how it all came together.
Well, first of all, thank you. I have a big smile on the face, and it feels really weird right now. I just got to say, it just all of a sudden you're a doctor, and it's just very bizarre.
Is it one of those things where you practice your new writing, your new name, you know, like on your notebook, you write doctor, Kimberly Senna-Moore.
Do not admit to that.
No, I didn't do that, but I had actually, what's funny is that one of the first things I did was I changed my email signature. So that was kind of, I think, my equivalent of writing it out. But it was so the process itself, I actually really enjoyed it. That this defense process is very similar, I think, for anybody who's getting a PhD, music therapy or otherwise. And there's a public presentation. So I prepared about a 30-minute presentation on my dissertation research. And like I said, it's open to the public. And then they open it up to questions from the public. And this part is more, it's a really nice, I found, at least maybe it's my committee, I don't know, but it's been a really nice discussion. And so people, you know, can ask questions and you get, it generates new ideas. So there's this, opens it up to questions from the public, and then the committee kicks the public out, and then it's just you with the committee. And again, more, at least in my case, more of a discussion and some feedback on my dissertation. I have some revisions I have to do, nothing significant, but more just suggestions, ideas, talking, generating again, more ideas. And then they kick me out and they talk. And then somebody opens the door, my chair opened the door and said, "Is there a Dr. Senamore in the building?" And that was it. I was done.
Oh, that was she it. Is now.
And then I cried. So it was, it's also a bit surreal because the change, it happens right then. And yet you work so long for something like this that it just, it's a good feeling, but it's still surreal. So thank you for sharing that. I am really, really excited, and I'm going to be graduating. I'm going with my husband and my kids. We're going to Kansas City in May, and I'll be walking, and they have this whole hooding that they do that I've never seen before. So I'll tell you more about it later. But it's, I don't know. I'm very happy.
Well, congratulations. We're all very proud of you.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Thank you.
And I'd like to share another announcement, and that is my other website that I do with Rachel C, Music Therapy eBooks, is celebrating its 1 year birthday. Yay!
So, that's awesome. Congratulations.
Yeah, we can't believe it. It went by so fast. And the website has really grown. It's we wanted to create a platform where music therapists can sell their eBooks, and then a part of that is that other music therapists can buy eBooks that will help them in their practice and their professional life. And now we have 17 authors on there. We have over 25 eBooks on the website, and we just are really proud of it. And we're just so thankful to all you folks out there for helping Music Therapy eBooks be a success through your comments and likes and retweets and shares. And it's just been instrumental to getting the word out to the masses. And our birthday isn't really a testament about us. It's a testament to the fans. So we're really happy about that. And we have another cool announcement, and that is that we, Rachel C. and I, wrote an ebook, and that is going to be out April 1st. And it's called How to Write an Ebook, ebook. And it's a handbook for music therapists. And so it just walks you through the whole process of creating your own self-published manuscript. And so we talk about brainstorming, questions to ask yourself when you're developing your focus, editing advice, establishing your production timeline. There's just tons of information in it. So please be on the lookout for it on the website, musictherapyebooks.com, on April 1st.
Congratulations, Michelle and Rachel C. That's fantastic.
Thank you for joining us. To see the show notes, go to www.musictherapyroundtable.com. If you like this podcast, take your skills to the next level by joining the Music Therapy Pro community. For only $17 per month, you will get unlimited access to CMTEs, in-depth clinical skills podcasts, and other invaluable resources designed to empower you to take charge of your personal and professional growth.